Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain. The Prime Minister will address a joint session of Congress convened for this purpose. As is customary, each house was called to order at 12 noon today, and after the opening preliminaries had been dispensed with, recess was ordered, and now the members of the Senate have taken seats in the House chamber awaiting the arrival of the Prime Minister, who will be announced by doorkeeper William Fishbait Miller. Just 9 days ago, the Prime Minister was here as the guest of President Truman when the President delivered his address on the State of the Union. At that time, Mr. Churchill sat beside Mrs. Truman in the President's gallery. That was his first visit to this House chamber since its extensive redecoration, which brought considerable comment from some members 2 years ago because of its soft lighting, built-in wall coverings, air conditioning, and improved acoustics. The Prime Minister arrived back in Washington yesterday afternoon and was installed yesterday as a member of the Society of the Cincinnati, for which he qualified through his American mother's ancestors, which dates back to Lieutenant Reuben Maury, who was an officer of the Connecticut Continental Line in the Revolutionary War. Now, here's doorkeeper Miller.
The Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Well, of course, you can hear the ovation that the Prime Minister is receiving as he is walking down the aisle. As is usual on occasions of this sort, the House chamber is filled to capacity and the galleries are filled. The Prime Minister has just reached the well of the House, where he's being escorted by committees which were appointed from both the House and Senate side. And now he's good to rock. Churchill now is taking in with Vice President Barkley and a few words, and now with Speaker Sam Rayburn. He's turned around, and he is not smiling. He's looking very serious. His skin has tilted up, and he is standing, waiting for the ovation to lie down. He's taking his teeth out of his pocket. And in just a moment, we'll hear Speaker Sam Rayburn introduce the Prime Minister.
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure, the high privilege, and the distinguished honor of presenting to you the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Still, the Prime Minister is not smiling. He's looking very serious as he gazes around the House chamber. Now, here we
go. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Congress, this is the third time it has been my fortune to address the Congress of the United States upon our joint affairs. I am honored indeed by these experiences, which I believe are unique for one who is not an American citizen. It is also of great value to me, on again becoming the head of His Majesty's government, to come over here and take counsel with many trusted friends and comrades of former anxious days. There is a lot for us to talk about together so that we can understand each other's difficulties, feelings, and thoughts, and do our best for the common cause. Let us, therefore, survey the scene this afternoon with cool eyes, undimmed by hate or passion, guided by righteous inspiration, and not uncheered by hope. I have not come here to ask you for money. To ask you for money to make life more comfortable or easier for us in Britain. Our standards of life are our own business, and we can only keep our self-respect and independence by looking after them ourselves. During the war, we bore our share of the burden and fought from first to last, unconquered, and for a while alone, to the utmost limit of our resources. Your majestic obliteration of all you gave us under Lend-Lease will never be forgotten by this generation of Britons or by history. After the war, unwisely, as I contended, and certainly contrary to American advice, we accepted as normal debts nearly 4,000 million pounds sterling of claims by countries we had protected from invasion or had otherwise aided, instead of making counterclaims, which would at least have reduced the bill to reasonable proportions. The 1,000 million loan we borrowed from you in 1946, and which we are now repaying, was spent not on ourselves, but mainly in helping others. In all, since the war, as the late government affirmed, we have lent or given to European or Asiatic countries 1,300 million pounds in the form of unrequited exports. This added to the cost of turning over our industry from war to peace and rebuilding homes shattered by bombardment was more than we could manage without an undue strain upon our life energies, from which we shall require both time and self-discipline to recover. Why do I say all this? Not to compare our financial resources with yours, we are but a third your numbers, and much less than a third your wealth. Not to claim praise or rewards, but to convince you of our native and enduring strength, and that our true position is not to be judged by the present state of the dollar exchange or by sterling area finance. Our production is half as great again as it was before the war. Our exports are up by two-thirds. Recovery, while being retarded, has been continuous, and we are determined that it shall go on. As I said at Fulton in Missouri 6 years ago, under the auspices of President Truman, let no man underrate the abiding power of the British Commonwealth and Empire. Do not suppose we shall not come through these dark years of privation as we came through the glorious years of agony, or that half a century from now you will not see 70 or 80 millions of Britons spread about the world and united in defense of our traditions, our way of life, and of the world causes which you and we espouse. If the population of the English-speaking Commonwealth be added to that of the United States, with all that such cooperation implies in the air, on the sea, and all over the globe, and in science, industry, and moral force, there will be no quivering, precarious balance of power to offer its temptations to ambition or adventure. I am very glad to be able to say the same to you here today. It is upon this basis of recovery, in spite of burden, that the formidable problem of the new rearmament has fallen upon us. It is the policy of the United States to help forward in many countries the process of rearmament. In this, we, who contribute ourselves two-thirds as much as the rest of Europe put together, require your aid if we are to realize in good time the very high level of military strength which the Labour government boldly aimed at and to which they committed us. It is for you to judge to what extent the United States' interests are involved, whether you aid us much or little, we shall continue to do our utmost in the common cause. But, members of the Congress, our contribution will perforce be limited by our own physical resources, and thus the combined strength of our two countries and also of the free world will be somewhat less than it might be. That is why I have come here to ask, not for gold, but for steel, not for favors, but equipment. And that is why many of our requests have been so well and generously met. At this point, I will venture, if I may, to make a digression. After a lot of experience, I have learned that it is not a good thing to dabble in the internal politics of another country. It's hard enough to understand one's own. But I will tell you something about our British politics all the same. In our island, we indulge from time to time in having elections. I believe you sometimes have them over here. We have had a couple in 20 months, which is quite a lot and quite enough for the time being. We now look forward to a steady period of administration in accordance with the mandate we have received. Like you, we tend to work on the two-party system. The differences between parties on our side of the Atlantic, and perhaps elsewhere, between British parties, are often less than they appear to outsiders. In modern Britain, the dispute is between a form of socialism which has hitherto respected political liberty on the one hand, and on the other, free enterprise regulated by law and custom. These two systems of thought, whose differences, I assure you, give plenty of room for argument between political opponents, fortunately overlap quite a lot in practice. Our complicated society would be deeply injured if we did not practice and develop what is called in the United States the bipartisan habit of mind, which divides, so far as possible, what is done to make a party win and bear in their turn the responsibility of office, and what is done to make the nation live and serve high causes. I hope here, members of Congress, you will allow me to pay a tribute to the late Senator Vandenberg. I had the honor to meet him on several occasions. His final message in these anxious years gave the feeling that in this period of United States leadership and responsibility, all the great Americans should work together for all the things that matter most. That at least is the spirit which we shall try to maintain among British leaders in our own country. And that was the spirit which alone enabled us to survive the perils of the late war. But now let me return to my theme of the many changes that have taken place since I was last here. There is a jocular saying, to improve is to change, to be perfect is to have changed often. I had to use that once or twice in my long career. But If that were true, everyone ought to be getting on very well. The changes that have happened since I last spoke to Congress are indeed astounding. It is hard to believe we are living in the same world. Former allies have become foes. Former foes have become allies. Conquered countries have been liberated. Liberated nations have been enslaved by communism. Russia, 8 years ago, our brave ally, has cast away the admiration and goodwill her soldiers had gained for her by their valiant defense of their own country. It is not the fault of the Western powers if an immense gulf has opened between us. It took a long succession of deliberate and unceasing words and acts of hostility to convince our peoples, as they are now convinced, that they have another tremendous danger to face, and that they are now confronted with a new form of tyranny and aggression, as dangerous and as hateful as that which we overthrew. When I visited Washington during the war, I used to be told that China would be one of the big four powers among the nations and most friendly to the United States. I was always a bit skeptical, and I think it is now generally admitted that this hopeful dream has not yet come true. But I am by no means sure that China will remain for generations in the communist grip. The Chinese said of themselves several thousand years ago, China is a sea that salts all the waters that flow into it. There's another Chinese saying about their country which is much more modern. It dates only from the 4th century. This is to say, the tail of China is large and will not be wagged. I like that one. The British democracy approves the principle of movable party heads and unwaggable national tails. It is due to the working of these important forces that I have the honor to be addressing you at this moment. You have rightly been resolute members of the Congress in confronting Chinese communist aggression. We take our stand at your side. We are grateful to you. We are grateful to the United States for bearing 9/10 or more of the burden in Korea, which the United Nations have morally assumed. I am very glad that whatever diplomatic divergences there may be from time to time about procedure, you do not allow the Chinese anti-communists on Formosa to be invaded and massacred from the mainland. We welcome your patience in the armistice negotiations, and our two countries are agreed that if the truce we seek is reached only to be broken, our response will be prompt, resolute, and effective. What I have learnt over here convinces me that British and United States policy in the Far East will be marked by increasing harmony. I can assure you that our British hearts go out in sympathy to the families of the 100,000 Americans who have given their lives or shed their blood in Korea. We also suffer these pangs for the loss of our own men there, and not only there, but in other parts of Asia as well, under the attack by the same enemy. Whatever course events in Korea may take in the near future, and prophesy would be difficult, much too difficult for me to embark upon it, I am sure our soldiers and your soldiers have not made their sacrifice in vain. The cause of world law has found strong and invaluable defense, and the foundations of the world instrument for preserving peace, justice, and freedom among the nations have been deepened and strengthened. They stand now not on paper, but on rock. Moreover, the action which President Truman took in your name and with your full support in his stroke against aggression in Korea has produced consequences far beyond Korea, consequences which may well affect the destiny of mankind. The vast process of American rearmament, in which the British Commonwealth and Empire and the growing power of united Europe will play their part to the utmost of their strength, this vast process has already altered the balance of the world and may well, if we all persevere steadfastly and loyally together, avert the danger of a third world war or the horror and of defeat and subjugation should one come upon us. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, I hope the mourning families throughout the great republic will find some comfort and some pride in these thoughts. Another extraordinary change has taken place in the Far East since I last addressed you. Peace has been made with Japan. There, indeed, I congratulate you upon the policy which, in wise and skillful hands, has brought the Japanese nation from the woe and shame of defeat in their wicked war back to that association with the Western democracies upon which the revival of their traditions, dignity, and happiness can alone be regained and the stability of the Far East assured. In the anxious and confused expanses of Southeast Asia, there is another sphere where our aims and interests and those of the French who are fighting bravely at heavy cost to their strength in Europe may find a fertile field for agreement on policy. I feel sure that the conversations we have had between our two foreign secretaries, Mr. Eden and Mr. Acheson, men whose names and experience are outstanding throughout the world, will help to place the problems of Southeast Asia in their right setting. It would not be helpful to the common cause, for our evils all spring from one center, if an effective truce in Korea led only to a transference of communist aggression to these other fields. Our problems will not be solved unless they are steadily viewed and acted upon as a whole, in their integrity as a whole. In the Middle East, enormous changes have also taken place since I was last in power in my own country. When the war ended, the Western nations were respected and predominant throughout these ancient lands, and there were quite a lot of people who had a good word to say about Great Britain. Today, it is a somber and confusing scene. Yet there is still sunshine as well as Cheddar. From the date of the Balfour Declaration, I have desired that the Jews should have a national home, and I worked for that end. I rejoice to pay my tribute here to the achievements of those who have founded the Israelite state, who have defended themselves with tenacity, and who offer asylum to great numbers of Jewish refugees. I hope that with their aid, they may convert deserts into gardens. But if they are to enjoy peace and prosperity, they must strive to renew and preserve their friendly relations with the Arab world, without which widespread misery might swallow all. Britain's power to influence the fortunes of the Middle East and guard it from aggression is far less today, now that we have laid aside our imperial responsibility for India and its armies. It is no longer for us alone to bear the whole burden of maintaining the freedom of the famous waterway of the Suez Canal. That has become an international rather than a national responsibility. I welcome the statesmanlike conception of a four-power approach to Egypt announced by the late British government, in which Britain, the United States, France, and Turkey may share with Egypt in the protection of the world interests involved, among which Egypt's own interests are paramount. Such a policy is urgent. Britain is maintaining over 50,000 troops in the Suez Canal zone, who again might be well employed elsewhere, not for national vainglory or self-seeking advantage, but in the common interest of all nations. We do not seek to be masters of Egypt. We are there only as the servants and guardians of the commerce of the world. It would enormously aid us in our task if even token forces of the other partners in the four-power proposal were stationed in the canal zone as a symbol of the unity of purpose which inspires us. And I believe it is no exaggeration to state that such token forces would probably bring into harmony all that movement by which the four-power policy may be made to play a decisive part by peaceful measures and bring to an end the wide disorders of the Middle East, in which, let me assure you, there lurk dangers not less great than those which the United States have stemmed in Korea. Now I come to Europe, where the greatest of all our problems and dangers lie. I have long worked for the cause of United Europe, and even of a United States of Europe, which would enable that continent, the source of so much of our culture, ancient and modern, and the parent of the new world, to resume and revive its former splendors. It is my sure hope and conviction that European unity will be achieved, and that it will not ultimately be limited only to the countries at present composing Western Europe. I said at Zurich in 1946 that France should take Germany by the hand and lead her back into the family of nations, and thus end the thousand-year quarrel which has torn Europe to pieces and finally plunged the whole world twice over into slaughter and havoc. Real and rapid progress is being made towards European unity. and it is both the duty and the policy of both Great Britain and our Commonwealth and of the United States to do our utmost, all of us, to help and speed it. As a forerunner of United Europe, there is the European Army, which could never achieve its necessary strength without the inclusion of Germany. If this necessary and urgent object is being achieved by the fusion of the forces of the continental nations outside what I have called in former times the Iron Curtain, that great operation deserves our fullest support. But, members of Congress, fusion is not the only way in which the defense of Western Europe can be built. The system of a grand alliance, such as has been created by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is no bar to the fusion of as many of its members as wish for this closer unity. And the United States, British, and Canadian troops will stand, indeed are already standing, shoulder to shoulder with their European comrades in defense of the civilization and freedom of the West. We stand together under General Eisenhower to defend the common cause from violent aggression. Stand together. What matters most is not the form of fusion or melding, a word I learned over here, but the numbers of divisions and of armored divisions and the power of the air forces and their weapons available for unified action under the Supreme Commander. We in Britain have denuded our island of military formations to an extent I have never seen before. And I cannot accept the slightest approach from any quarter that we are not doing our full duty because the British Commonwealth of Nations, spread all over the world, is not prepared to become a state or group of states in any continental federal system on either side of the Atlantic. The sooner strong enough forces can be assembled in Europe under united command, the more effective will be the deterrent against a third world war. The sooner also will our sense of security and the fact of our security be seen to reside in valiant, resolute, and well-armed manhood rather than in the awful secret which science has wrested from nature. These are at present, it must be recognized, these secrets, the supreme deterrent against the Third World War and the most effective guarantee of victory in it. If I may say this, members of the Congress, be careful above all things, therefore, not to let go of the atomic weapons until you are sure, and more than sure, that other means of preserving peace are in your hands. It is my belief that by accumulating deterrence of all kinds against aggression, we shall in fact ward off the fearful catastrophe, the fears of which darken the life and mar the progress of all the people of the globe. We must persevere steadfastly and faithfully in the task to which, under United States leadership, we have solemnly bound ourselves. Any weakening of our purpose, any disruption of our organization, would bring about the very evils which we all dread, and from which we should all suffer, and from which many of us would perish. We must not lose patience, and we must not lose hope. It may be that presently a new mood will reign behind the Iron Curtain, if so it will be easy for them to show it. But the democracies must be on their guard against being deceived by a false dawn. We seek or covet no one's territory. We plan no forestalling war. We trust and pray that all will come right. Even during these years of what is called the Cold War, material production in every land is continually improving through the use of new machinery and better organization and the advance of peaceful science. But the great bound forward in progress and prosperity for which mankind is longing cannot come till the shadow of war has passed away. There are, however, historic compensations for the stresses which we suffer in the Cold War. Under the pressure and menace of communist aggression, the fraternal association of the United States with Britain and the British Commonwealth, and the new unity growing up in Europe, nowhere more hopeful than between France and Germany, all these harmonies are being brought forward, perhaps by several generations, in the destiny of the world. If this proves true, and it has certainly proved true up to date, the architects in the Kremlin may be found to have built a different and a far better world structure than what they planned. Members of the Congress, I have dwelt today repeatedly upon many of the changes that have happened throughout the world since you last invited me to address you here. And I am sure you will agree that it is hardly possible to recognize the scene or believe it can truly have come to pass. But there is one thing that is exactly the same as when I was here last. Britain and the United States are working together and working for the same high cause. Bismarck once said that the supreme fact of the 19th century was that Britain and the United States spoke the same language. Let us make sure that the supreme fact of the 20th century is that they tread the same path.
You have just heard the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain, address a joint session of the Congress of the United States. This broadcast originated in the chamber of the House of Representatives in Washington. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.